today on I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Always appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to listen to what I have to say, and more importantly, listen to what my guests have to say. Today's guest is somebody that I saw, someone shared a post of theirs on LinkedIn that greatly intrigued me. And he speaks the truth. He says things that a lot of us want to say and are sometimes a little concerned about saying. But anyway, let's get started with Wayne Gillis, who's president and CEO of Rehoboth McKinley Christian Healthcare Services in Gallup, New Mexico.
Yes. So,
Wayne, welcome.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it. Happy to be here.
Thanks. It's great to have you. Well, before we get into your blog post, I'd really like to hear a little bit about life in rural healthcare, particularly in New Mexico, because there are a lot of challenges out there, aren't there?
Yeah, that's an understatement. You know, I think this state, when you think about some of the, you know, I'll hit malpractice as kind of one of the biggies that really is a challenge for all the hospitals in New Mexico, but definitely in rural healthcare. When we look at no caps on punitive damages, you know, it really puts a hospital like our size really at risk. The other challenge coupled with that, as this has continued and we've continued to have more, you know, larger claims. I think last year there was one of the largest claims that had ever been. It was $412 million that was out of Albuquerque. And that, you know, is devastating to a small hospital, obviously. Where the big challenge with that is when you try to get malpractice insurance, you know, becomes very, very difficult. We currently now are only at one insurer that is willing to actually write policies within the state. And if that, you know, was to change, then it would really be pretty devastating. The other piece to that is when you look at private practice or private practice groups, they're in the same boat. Mm-hmm. And it is significantly limiting our ability to be able to recruit physicians because of the risk, right? Either one's to partner with us and be employed. And even if they are employed and they're covered under the malpractice piece, we are covering them. It's still something potentially because people are kind of, you know, risk averse if you think about it. And that is definitely not the case here. You know, a lot of people will tend to sue for a whole bunch of stuff because they can actually get a payday. And so all that stuff goes on a provider's record, right? Mm-hmm. So that also is a deterrent for them to be able to want to come. The other thing I think for us, as we look at, it's a large state, you know, there's around 3 million people in the state. And when we look at the population and the distance between some of the rural hospitals and the population that we serve, it's a pretty large geographic area.
Sure.
And so we have a pretty big deficit, I guess, if you will, related to, you know, appointment cancellations. People have actually real life issues like transportation. It's a big deal. You know, here we don't have transit systems, right, that go on the reservation and will pull people out there so they can come to their appointments. And so that is a big challenge. The third thing for us is recruitment of staff. You know, just, you know, when you think about, you know, in a larger area, you've got a lot more to pull from. You know, we kind of have a puddle instead of a pond.
Mm-hmm.
It's just small, right? It just is small. And so we have to figure out ways creatively to be able to kind of raise the bar, educate people, bring them along in order for us, because we're not going to be able to necessarily hire a bunch of really seasoned people. We're going to have to train them up is how we'll have to do it here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I'm here in Central Texas in a community of about 160,000 people, and we face the same issues.
Yeah,
because we have people, you know, healthcare people are wanting to live in the larger cities like a Dallas, Worth, or Austin, and so we face a lot of those same issues. And ironically, one of my former residents is an associate administrator in Silver City, New Mexico, and he has said the same thing about challenges in recruitment there. So tell me a little bit, and I spent some time in outstate Nebraska, so I know really well where the geographic concerns that you have. My hospital, we serve about 300,000 people in the geography size of the state of Indiana. And so, yeah, tell me a little bit about your catchment area and about the number of people that you serve.
Yeah, we have. So for us, it's probably about 125-mile radius. Mm-hmm. So it's a, and I would say in that 125-mile radius, we probably support 80 to 100,000 people. And there's a blend of that. We're the only acute dialysis kind of in our, probably within 150 miles.
Okay.
And so that we get a lot of, you know, patients that get referred over from the Indian, because we have the Indian Hospital is actually right in the same town with us.
Okay.
There are services that they don't do, you know, and so that is probably one of the biggest draws that we have from the Indian Hospital is related to kind of acute dialysis, new catheter placements, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The biggest challenge, honestly, for us is on the reservation. There's still so many people, it boggles my mind, honestly, that don't have running water, don't have electricity. Yep. Still. And so that becomes really a challenge on discharge, right? Trying to figure out how do we support them? Somebody's a diabetic. They don't have a way to keep their insulin cold. I mean, it's just those challenges that I hadn't always experienced, you know, previously to this magnitude before.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I've spent some time in Kentucky as well, facing some of those very similar issues. I was there in the late 90s and was still so shocked that people didn't have running water.
Yeah.
But it was real.
Yes.
And so same thing, we had to face a lot of that. So with you being on Interstate 40, is Albuquerque your tertiary destination typically?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. I thought it might be. And so how far is that?
Hour and 45 minutes.
Oh, good grief. Okay. Yeah.
I would say if we've got something acute that we can't handle, we'll fly them.
Yeah. So
the majority of the time it's being flown by helicopter.
Okay. I would hope so. That'd be a little difficult of a drive.
Yes.
So let's dig into some of your blog posts that I just loved. The one really caught my attention. It's so timely. When you said the most dangerous room in healthcare might be the boardroom, you know, elaborate on that because I totally agree with you.
I'm in it for multiple contexts, from absolutely the boardroom standpoint of actually having the board there, but also thinking about the boardroom because most places, you know, will have your mid-levels, you know, the executive team meets in the boardroom most of the time. And there's so much that we sometimes, you know, some of it's, I think, ego related as it relates to kind of us as leaders and feeling this compelling, you know, desire that we need to know the answers, right? And we need to be able to solve this. And a lot of us that are executives and leaders want to be problem solvers. And so they do want to make things better and their heart's in the right place. But there is so many times that we do not have the right people sitting around the table. And so we are making decisions or designing processes or designing programs, and we are doing it too far away from where the work's actually being done. And so we make some big mistakes. Some of them, you know, are operational and they increase delays and frustration for our staff, but some of them are dangerous, right? Because we can put things and processes in place that actually have holes in them, you know, are not tried and true, are not what we would consider to be, you know, how we have kind of managed through all the Swiss cheese, right? Where we've got the problem prone out of the way and we make sure that it's very, very easy to do the right thing and very hard to do the wrong thing. And you have to have the right people in the room to be able to do that. And so when I was probably coming up in management, But even when I was a bedside nurse, you know, there was a lot of times where things would happen in the organization and be changed. And you could tell that nobody has asked the right people to do that because the process doesn't work, or it's very clunky, or there's multiple steps and it's really onerous. And so for me, as I moved up in healthcare, I didn't want to be one of those people, you know? And so I want to make sure that I stay connected in the organization and I listen to everybody at all levels of the organization. And when we are, you know, really trying to solve problems, that we need to make sure that we go all the way to where the actual action or the effort or the work is actually physically being done. Those people have to be engaged in the process and the problem solving.
No, you're exactly right. And in today's particularly reimbursement environment and try having to be as efficient as possible, you know, focusing on productivity is huge, but there are oftentimes, you know, you can put an overemphasis on that productivity. You know, if somebody may have missed their target by 10, 15 minutes and we're making, you know, we're focusing on that versus what that 10 or 15 minutes meant in patient care, you know, that's a huge issue. And we ran into that often because of a greater emphasis at the corporate level on productivity. Not that we weren't always focusing on it, but so that's number one. And number two, making just simple changes that you think as an administrator wouldn't make a hill of beans.
You're right.
Case in point, we had a hallway in between two of our towers that was all windows, okay, and on both sides. And so it was very bright in there. It got awfully warm in there. And so, you know, here I am trying to be, you know, trying to be nice and trying to keep things cool. So I said, why don't we put some sort of a film up there? You know, it'll cool off at least one side of the hallway. It also will block a really ugly view of some of our backstage things. Well, I did that. I didn't consider, you know, I didn't think to ask staff, did you? Literally 2 or 3 days after the film went up, I started getting, whose idiotic idea was that? And here we're in. Raising my hand. I'm trying to make it cooler. Well, now it's ugly. It's dark. We didn't mind. I'm like, okay, I'm sorry. But that happens all the time.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's not, there's not decisions made to be contrary. You think you're helping, but yes, if you involve all the right people, they fall flat on their face.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. What has been interesting, kind of a spinoff or lessons learned from that is, you know, we've started a Bright Idea program. And so what that means is that, you know, it every single department in the organization, you know, we have a formal way to do it, right? You have to have structure around it. We have a Bright Idea board, so it's visible, because I want it visible, because if you don't want to forget things, one of the things that is immensely frustrating to staff is, you know, you ask them for their ideas and then you do nothing about it, right? It just is terrible. And so the, you know, exciting thing is it really engages the hearts and minds of everybody in the organization. And it's run by the team, not by the director, not by the supervisor. But there is a accountability, right? That we make sure that things are being followed up. We've got the right attention and support to it. But, you know, as organizations, to me, need to continue to grow, you've got to engage and pull out of all of your staff and across the organization to be able to actually have them feel like they're empowered and have control of their own destiny. And that ultimately, you can capture that, align that with your strategic objectives, and it starts to move the organization really fast.
Yeah.
And you don't have those boardroom issues, right? Because there's a lot of transparency and there's good communication and people are willing to talk and give their ideas and or give their feedback, just like your team did, right? You need to know that. And it was good that they felt comfortable they could do that.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So we're going to make a little transition here. You were talking about the physicians. You were talking about recruitment of physicians. I loved your blog about when you ask five young physicians what they fear the most. And the first one is really, it's sad because I know the reason why most people go into medicine is to help people. And the first one was, burnout will become my norm, not my exception. Talk a little bit about that.
You know, and it's been trending for a while. So if you think about, you know, I've been in healthcare 35 years. So, you know, I documented on paper, right? But I also saw the transition to electronic health record. And you know, the ideas behind the EHR were fantastic. They were, you know, this altruistic kind of view that it was going to have transparency and we were going to impact patient care and it was going to be positive and blah, blah, blah. And those were great ideas. We were just so far away from that. And so now you fast forward, you know, to here it is 2025. And you're, you know, the last few years, you've got ambient listening. You've now gotten, you know, AI being interjected into there. But there, that is not, it's not available to everybody and it's expensive. And so when you think about the large majority of community hospitals, rural healthcare hospitals, but even the ones that are, you know, 150 beds or less, they're going to be limited on what they actually can afford from a tool standpoint to help prevent some of this stuff. And so just like with the nurses, the physicians, there's a lot of documentation, a lot of regulation. You know, the insurance companies are continually, they have all their AI, right? They're making a ton of money. And so they're scrubbing all these claims and rejecting all this stuff back, and it's dumping back into the organization as well as the providers. And they're feeling that pressure. And that has just continued to build and build and build. You have them, you know, on work RVUs wanting to make a good income, but then also having to stay 2 or 3 hours after their clinic ends so they can finish their notes.
Yeah.
Right. And so, or take it home. And so those are not sustainable things. And we've been doing this for a decade.
Yeah.
And so it's super frustrating for them. Where I see the biggest thing that when we think about, which is why I think the younger physicians are more apt to give an opinion, is they are much better than we are, definitely in my generation, with wanting work-life balance.
Yes.
They're way more over like, I'm not going to do X, right? We would just do whatever you ask us to do. Stay till 10 o'clock, we stay till 10 o'clock, right? That generation is gone. You know, the new one is different. And so it is very, very real for us where we've got to figure out how we can make this stuff efficient for them. Because it is also, to your point, it is taking the joy out of medicine for them because they don't feel like they can really give good care and they can really focus. They're always constantly checking a list off, and that's not satisfying for providers. It's not satisfying for any clinician, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Another point that you made there about the physician self, my decisions will be dictated by insurance, not evidence. I'll go ahead and throw the boardroom in there too. But you're exactly right. You know, I talked to so many of my physicians here that are so frustrated because they said non-clinicians are practicing medicine on a regular basis. And here I am, I'm the one that's laid eyes on that patient, that's done all the diagnostics, that know what I am proposing is the right treatment course.
Right.
And yet I've got somebody looking at an algorithm telling me, no, you can't, we're not covering that. You're not going to be doing that.
Yes.
You know, and back to what you were saying, as far as involving your staff in decision-making, making sure that the physicians are involved in decision-making within the hospital is also huge to me, because everything you and I do as administrators directly affect them.
Oh, it does. Yeah, it does. That's absolutely true. That's why they have to be at the table, right? Yeah. And there's that fine line, I think, for me, as because this has been a turnaround here. And so the fine line has been, I have to have a significant amount of transparency so they know why and what we're doing. But also, there is only so much they're going to be able to really they didn't take accounting, right? So, you know, yeah, having, you know, balance sheets and really understanding what that all means is not necessarily going to be easy for them, but there's a way for us to communicate and educate them and bring them up to speed so they're engaged in the process. Mm-hmm. And they can help us make financial decisions if we can empower them with enough information to have them feel like they can actually do it intelligently.
Absolutely. Well, and sometimes those decisions, particularly to clinicians, feel like the business people are trying to ration care. But, you know, as you said, you came there for a turnaround. I had one of my nuns years ago tell me, look, Kevin, no margin, no mission. So I get it. And I said, if the nuns get it, then we should also understand that too and be able to communicate that to our providers. And it's not necessarily rationing care. It's just being smart about, yep, you know, maybe that treatment course is not appropriate for the hospital. Maybe we need to transfer that patient out.
Yes.
So, and making that tough decision. Okay, here comes another topic that we've talked a lot about on my show and that we as administrators talk a lot about is the new consumerism in healthcare. Physicians said, patients will trust me even if I do everything right. Thank you, internet. Thank you, TikTok. Everybody has stayed in a Holiday Inn Express and thinks they've gone to med school now, right?
That's true. No, you're absolutely right. Well, and you think about there, it's been pushed too, because all these pharmaceutical companies, right, when they have these new drugs coming out, or if we've got new equipment for new procedures coming out, they're so bombarded, bombard the public. And so they're coming in and saying, hey, I want my knee done and I want it done with a robot, right? Not having the physician decide, are you a candidate for that? Be the best option for you for the best outcome, right? So I totally get it. They're being pushed or wedged into corners.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Who would have thought, you know, 10 years ago that we would be seeing commercials on network TV about a Watchman procedure to, you know, to cover an LAOO.
Yeah.
I always get that confused. Anyway, I would have never have thought that early in my career. I mean, that is a state-of-the-art procedure that, you know, now the patients are involved in, you know, bringing that to the physician saying, I want them, but maybe it's not appropriate. Maybe that's not something that's done at your hospital or whatever. So,
well, and then I also think too, to spark that, which I guess is part of the strategy, you know, that it wedges the organization and the physician kind of in the middle where, you know, we've got things that are not being paid for, or the reimbursement doesn't even come close to covering what the cost of the equipment is. And now you don't have any real leverage, right, to kind of push back, to wait until the actual, it's reasonableness, right, from a payer standpoint that we actually can do the procedure and not lose, you know, thousands of dollars for every single patient that we treat.
Yeah. I loved what a friend of mine said to me the other day. We were talking about this and he said, you know, it's not a surprise that all the new drugs and all the new technology aren't costing less, right? And I said, yeah, you're exactly right. You know, nothing is being created that's going to save us any money.
That is absolutely true.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to your disruptor column. And we've got a few minutes, but there's some things here that I really want to talk about. First one, man, we saw this in COVID, didn't we? The workforce shift from career to a gig mentality. Not just nurses, not just techs, but physicians too.
Yes. Yeah. I've had that even more here.
Yeah.
The philosophy. And I don't know if it's necessarily a cross rule. When I was in Great Falls at, you know, 60,000 people. So it was a little bit bigger mm-hmm. city. We have 20 plus thousand here, but I would say probably half of my medical staff, you know, have either a condo or something here, do not live here primarily. They live wherever, whether it's Texas, some actually are in Albuquerque, they are in New Mexico, and they do a week on, week off, and they've been doing it for a decade.
Yeah.
And so it works for them. And so it's new for me, honestly, because I didn't really have that in any of my other previous roles around the country. But we're trying to figure out, because of course their pay scale is a little bit different than a nurse, right? Where we have some staffing options that are going to be like that, especially for echo techs, ultrasound techs, you know, some of those kind of one or two really high, you know, they're hard to find. There's not a ton of them out there, but to try to figure out how can we be flexible with that so we can get the right level of talent, but not force them to have to live in a rural community that they don't want to live in.
Yeah. Well, and again, we face that here, as I said earlier, here in Waco. Waco is a great town, but it's not a great town if you're a young single person. You know, I'm totally honest with that. And so, you know, you get out of school, you want to go, you know, and the work-life balance comes into play here. They want to be able to go to restaurants, clubs, you know, cultural events, whatever. We have some of that here, but we don't have the magnitude that Dallas, Fort Worth, or Austin has by any means. And so it's been difficult recruiting and retaining here. And hence the reason why even we in a city of this size ended up having to rely so much on contract nursing over the last 4 to 5 years. So, okay. So here's another one. And this scares me to death. You call it the quiet rural collapse. Talk about that and not just in OB and PEDS, just throughout.
Yeah. I think that, and so there's multiple things that I think are feeding into this. One, absolutely OB and PEDS. You know, you see there's, I see on Becker's, like every single week, there's more OB, you know, units that are closing around the country. And part of that, I think, is being even multiplied in a negative way from the standpoint of we have less babies being born. There's less pregnancies, right? And so then you spread that across the average, and there's a competence issue. I know for us, and it's probably the same in some other smaller communities, where you have to do a certain amount of labor. Mm-hmm. You have to deliver a certain amount of babies to have your staff remain competent.
Yes.
And so that's one barrier. The second barrier is that what is being required, where they want laborists, they want OB, you know, obstetricians, they want midwives, the staffing for that, for such a low reimbursement, it's an absolute tank related to reimbursement, right? I know our hospital friends that are about an hour from us that still have OB, you know, they're losing about $1.5 million a year.
Yeah.
And so when you, especially for us, we got to turn around. We can't afford that to do that. But then when you think about the other aspects of healthcare, when you look at specialists from a cardiology standpoint, endocrinology, you know, dermatology, there's just a lot of those specialists that you need to be able to keep the healthcare health of a community in a good place. But even we have long, long waits, 6 months to get into a cardiologist in Albuquerque. Sure. You know, if you've got somebody that has some taking time bomb, right, that it takes 6 months, they could have expired between then. And it's not that the physicians don't want to do it. It's there's not enough of them.
Oh, no kidding. Well, I mean, we face the issue in neurology here in Waco.
Yeah.
As I said, our catchment area, there's 500,000 people here. And we're an hour and 45 from both Dallas, Fort Worth, and Austin. In our town, one neurologist, one. And it's funny, and I know you've experienced the same thing I have, that over the last 10 years, you know, a neurologist 10 years ago did everything. And now a neurologist, a neurohospitalist, or you're just stroke, or you're just a movement disorder, or you're, you know, just doing outpatient, you know. And so, how are you going to find somebody to meet your community need if there might be five of those coming out of school every year?
It is a challenge. We're having to embrace technology.
Yeah.
When we think about telemedicine. Yeah. And so we're doing, you know, we're doing not, you know, dermatology. We're actually going to be able to have some support in that. Mm-hmm. But when you think about even telecardiology, because we want to have consistent coverage When we think about, you know, diabetics and endocrinology, that is also another specialty that's hard. Yeah. All the psych behavioral health piece can be done telemedicine. Even when we think about the support for hospitalist programs at night, mm-hmm. you know, be supported by telemedicine. And so we're having to figure out how do we embrace that. It's a very different way, though,
yeah.
to do medicine, especially in the acute care setting.
Yeah, absolutely.
The stroke, I think people got used to. And so they kind of, but now going into these other specialties, people are kind of like, they're really uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, they really are. They really are. Okay, the last point, and again, dead on, the generational divide in leadership philosophy. I mean, you and I, us old guys, hey, it's hierarchy, it's control, it's stability. But younger folks, work-life balance, collaboration, autonomy,
yep.
you know, that level of adaptability based upon the situation. You know, how are you dealing with your younger leaders in your hospital in that regard?
It's a challenge at times, to be blatantly honest with you.
Yeah.
So for me, understanding what they bring to the table, because I do think that when we think about it from both sides coming together, meeting in the middle, we're going to be in a better place. We really are, because I think my generation, we've kind of gotten too far. We work too much. We're workaholics. That is not healthy. And so, you know, they are a little bit of the other end of the spectrum, and we've got to figure out how we meet together. I think there's two things. One, they want to hear, they like to be taught, they like to be educated. And I've found that I can guide them by giving, okay, here's what we need to solve. You know, here's our boundaries, right? These are the two fence lines we have to stay within. And then we sit around the table and we kind of work through that together. I can get them where they're engaged. They have great ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're not as realistic as they need to be, but by us compromising, we can get there together. My probably biggest struggle with some of the leaders is they have a degree, and so they then think that has them where, okay, it's time for me to be a senior director, and then in about 6 months, I need to be a VP.
Right.
And some of them really do have that kind of mindset that you've got to help them see that it takes time to get experience. You need to bump your head. You need to make some mistakes. You need to grow as a professional in order for you to really be able to serve your team. Because now you're in this high level position, people are going to expect that you're going to make the right decisions. If your width of your experience is very skinny, as long as you stay within those demarcation lines, you're going to be good.
Yeah.
Problem is, that's probably not where most of your problems are going to come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you're going to be struggling with trying to figure out, how do I solve this? And so we need to build you a good toolbox, right? Where you've got all these tools in your pockets. And then you're going to be able to tackle those things. You can do it quickly, but you're going to have to be engaged in a different way. And you're going to have to open your eyes to be able to see past what you learned in school. And how do you apply a lot of that stuff into real life? Because it's definitely not the same always.
Boy, you're exactly right. And you made me laugh because I face that too. The younger kids, they don't even want to start as a manager. They want to start at that VP level.
That's true. Like,
okay. So did I. And I felt I did a pretty good job getting a CEO role at 35. So, you know, good for you. And we'll do what we can. So,
yeah, exactly.
Hey, Wayne, I've had a blast. This has been a lot of fun.
Same.
This has been a lot of fun. And we're going to do this again, because your blog posts really light a fire under me. And I think we need to do this often.
Okay, I'm good. I'm absolutely game for it.
You left out great.
Happy to be on it.
Hey, folks, I hope you enjoyed Wayne Gillis, the president and CEO of Rehoboth McKinley Christian Healthcare Services, as much as I did today. Another great episode of I Don't Care. Thank you so much for joining me, and we'll see you again next week. Take care. Wayne, that was a blast. I had so much fun.
You. Yeah, it was awesome. I love doing these things, actually.
Well, and you're great at it. I look down and I'm like, oh, crud, it's 27 minutes and I got another 20 minutes to go. But anyway, hey, what'll happen is my producers will do some edits, you know, a few edits at the beginning and the end. And we'll I think I'll be dropping this maybe mid latter part of next week.
Okay.
And I'll let you know. If you don't mind sharing it, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I'd love to.
And hey, something else, you know, like I said, I left my COO role about seven weeks ago or so, and I'm doing some advisory work for different companies. Would you mind if I see something that might benefit you guys, could I send it your way? Just let's take a look at it.
100%. Yes, sir.
Awesome. Please. I'll see. Yeah. I'll do it. Hey, take care. We'll be in touch.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
See ya. Bye.